this week's film. From the director of A Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child. From the director of Blown Away. From the director of Lost in Space. And the director of The Reaping. Oh God, what have we gotten ourselves into?
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who were these guys?
Judgment Night.
Oh, yes, it will be. Oh, yes, it will be. Welcome, everybody, to Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and co-pilot. He is a novelist, he is a screenwriter, he is a lieutenant in goddamn Megaforce, and that is Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And if you are interested in more of the rambling that we're doing right now, you can always find our cataloged episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow our thoughts. We actually have had quite a bit of interaction from our listeners lately, seeing a lot of great suggestions for movies that we should cover. And just we've had a lot of people tell us that they have bought movies that we have recommended and they've really enjoyed them, and that always makes us very happy. So please continue to interact with us on the Twitters and on the Facebooks. We're at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter and Facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And we really appreciate you guys doing that and using those Amazon links on our posts. That really does benefit us. Thank you so much. And we're going to continue our It Happened One Night series that we're doing all August long on Junk Food Cinema, and
with one of my crazy oddball picks.
Yeah. Last week's one that both of us saw a lot of growing up. This is one that I had heard of a few times, seen at video stores, like on the shelf.
The whole reason I picked this for this theme was because I knew you probably hadn't seen it, and it would force you to sit down and watch this.
Yeah,
because it's kind of one of those movies you kind of have to see at least once, because just conceptually, the cast is so fucking crazy.
Yeah.
That it's like, how is this a movie?
Yeah.
Like, how did this happen? But it was in that perfect window of time where all these actors were exactly where they were to make this movie that, you know, most of the cast has gone on to become kind of legendary actors.
And more important than where certain members of the cast were is where certain other actors who they wanted to play the roles weren't, which was available.
Oh, this is an alternate universe coming up.
Yeah, this is absolutely the case with a movie called Judgment Night.
What do you say, fight fans?
A night out on the town.
Yeah.
A heavy traffic jam.
Tell you something, I'm not going to miss this fight.
And one wrong turn. Judgment Night.
You coming?
Now, did you dig this?
I enjoyed this very much. I had a lot of fun with this. It felt super trashy. Like, just absolute. Like, when we talk about, I don't feel like we get to talk about a lot of exploitation on this show. And when we do, I'm always really excited. Like, this is, you know what? You know what I would call this is it's brosploitation. This may be
the greatest brosploitation movie.
It is the broiest movie I think I have seen, and I've seen all of the Hangover films, and yet this feels so much broier. It's just
bro.
Come on, bro. Come on, bro. This is a movie about four bros. On their way to a boxing match so that they can sit ringside, smoke cigars, get drunk, and go full on bro on one another. So, I mean, yeah, like, just from the beginning of the movie, before I tell you about the plot, let me just describe the opening scene of this film, because you kind of know immediately what kind of film is in terms of quality and appreciation that you're in for from the opening scene, which is this super needlessly slow slow-mo, like you're in a suburb and it's like, but hey, here's the trick and here's how we're gonna change things up and really blow your mind is we're gonna play hip hop during the slow motion pan through the suburbs. Isn't that crazy? We're gonna play this song that's sampling Tom Petty's Free Fallin', but it's totally a hip hop track, and isn't that crazy? And it's just like, oh, what do you guys think you're doing? Like what do you think you're establishing here? Because so far this just feels like I'm already like in my head. I know this was released in theaters, but I'm already seeing like a very straight to VHS type cover, forming in my head. This is a movie about four guys played by, and Cargill's right about this. This is the most insane part of this, is that the cast, our quartet of bros, are Emilio Estevez.
Yeah.
Cuba Gooding Jr.
Oh yeah,
Stephen Dorff,
as the younger little brother,
as the upstart hothead, and Jeremy Piven, full head of hair, still very much Ari Gold.
This is PCU days.
Yes, this is PCU days. Jeremy Piven, and Jeremy Piven's character is this kind of sleazy salesman who convinces an RV dealership that he wants to take clients out in their RV, so they allow him to do a test drive, and that's what they're going to ride up to this boxing match. And then we have Emilio Estevez, who's sort of our main character, our hero.
Our protagonist, if you will.
A protagonist, absolutely, as the French would say. And he is, he's a family man. He's actually kind of having a little bit of a tiff with his wife because she thinks his friends are very immature, and she is right.
And she's tired of him broing out.
She's like, tired of the broing. You need to step your bro game down a bit. You know, slow your bro a little bit, because you have a child, and you know, I don't get to go out either. And he's like, no, you know, the guys are fine, whatever. And of course they're all kind of douchey bros in their own right.
Which is what makes this movie what it is.
Yeah, it really does. It makes it like this weird little time capsule oddity. And I kind of think that's what I enjoyed the most about it, right down to the fact that, you know, as we talked about before, a lot of these movies, all these movies we're going to talk about, adhere to the idea of Murphy's Law. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong. And in this case, it starts to go wrong when they take an exit off the freeway to get around traffic, thinking, oh, well, we'll get right back on, and apparently end up in a post-apocalyptic wasteland where there are no such things as freeways.
Again, here is, you know, you're watching this movie, you're like, where the fuck are they? And it turns out, oh, by the way, Chicago.
Yeah.
Again. They were just out in Shermer, Illinois, and drive into a post-apocalyptic wasteland Chicago.
Yeah. Because every one of these movies is really going for the idea that when the sun goes down, the city becomes this hellscape of, like, litter and sadness, and
you belong to the city.
Barrel fires. Do you remember?
You belong to the night.
Do you remember Jason Takes Manhattan?
Oh yeah,
Friday the 13th Part 8.
What? How could you forget Friday the 13th Part 8?
I love Friday the 13th Part 8.
Oh,
it's fucking terrible, and I get that. I understand that. I still love the hell out of it, because in that movie, and this is apropos, I'm not going off. This is not a tangent. This is apropos. In that movie,
actually a tangent, but.
And shut up, you. In that movie, they make New York City,
by definition,
yeah, look like it is melting. Like, it can no longer suffer the burden of all the filth, and it's just turning, like, the whole city is becoming an above-ground sewer.
Yeah, and when you talk about New York, I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, you know, pre-Giuliani,
sure.
New York was a cesspool. You know, the people that hate Giuliani loved the cesspool. The people that love Giuliani hated the cesspool.
And right.
Say what you will, it's now a wonderful, shiny, gleaming island where only the rich can afford to live now.
Yeah. But the city, as it's the Chicago area as it's portrayed in Judgment Night, looks like it was built on brick and mortar and needles and slime. Like, it is just a scary, dilapidated nightmare town. And for some reason, my favorite thing about that is that some production designer got it in their head that the more newspaper that's on the ground, the scarier and more abandoned a place looks. So I can just imagine right before they yelled action, there's a guy.
A newspaper wrangler.
A newspaper wrangler who had to go around and grab them all up and then spread them around to make it a very deliberate type of completely abandoned, decrepit look. And he's just like, he's like a newsie. He's the modern day newsie. Extra, extra, read all about it. This town is scary because there are newspapers spread on the ground. But right down to the fact, the 90s time capsule thing, right down to the fact that what happens is they end up witnessing a murder, and the murder is committed by the leader of this ruthless gang, and the leader of the ruthless gang is played by
Dennis Leary.
Because when you think Hollywood tough guys, when you think of all of the character actors that really sell as villains, and especially homicidal villains, the name at the top of your list should be Dennis Leary, question mark?
Well, I like to think of this as a prequel to Demolition Man.
But even in Demolition Man, he's still like, and he's still a hero. Like in Demolition Man, he's like the leader of the revolution, you know. But in this movie, he's
a douchebag criminal.
But here's my question about that, and the first of many questions I have with this movie: how does he make money? Like there are like four people in this neighborhood where he operates. Where is he making all this money exactly? Like who, even if it's drugs, who the fuck is he selling to? He's literally living in like the abandoned city of the wasteland. Like,
well,
I don't understand.
We don't know that this is actually his neighborhood in particular. He knows the turf, but he's, you know, when we, you know, they witness a murder, but it's not like the typical witnessing of a murder. They actually hit a guy.
Yeah.
It turns out that guy's already been shot, and they go to try to take him to the hospital, and the people that shot him then try to chase them down.
Yeah.
And the guy, as it turns out, has ripped these guys off. Like, this is not an innocent dude. This guy tried to rip them off. And ultimately, what I love about the movie is Dennis Leary then makes one big, terrible mistake. And that one terrible mistake ruins everyone's night. And
he didn't look around and see if anyone was watching.
No. He knew they were there. But the thing was, is he could have let those people go and then said, get the fuck out of here. He was worried that they might have mentioned the name. So he knew that he was going to try to have to kill them. But they kind of left them off alone to themselves for a little while, giving them the opportunity to escape, which then leads to Dennis Leary and his gang of three other dudes, one of them also being Peter Green, which is awesome, who many will know as
Redbone.
What?
Redbone from hold on. No. Yeah, The Usual Suspects, and then also, of course, the crazy ass cop from Pulp Fiction who has a gimp in his basement.
Yeah. No, I mean he played the bad guy in tons of stuff, and he's awesome.
The guy who probably should have been cast as the leader of that gang.
But that's what that's part of what the charm that makes Judgment Night is the fact that Dennis Leary and Peter Green actually have a pretty cool chemistry as far as boss and underboss go, to where you get that these guys are also bros.
Yep.
And that they're
bro on both sides of the line. So much bro in this movie.
That's exactly what it is. And it literally what this movie is it's like the Warriors, except it's only following two groups, and you're watching the two groups kind of disintegrate over the course of the night as they all just kind of want to get their shit done and get home. And, you know, the Dennis Leary's gang, they're just kind of like, why are we fucking chasing these guys? You know, why are we doing it? This is retarded. This is ridiculous. You know, and I could say retarded because that's the type of movie that this is, that's the type of stuff that spills out of Dennis Leary's mouth, where there's a certain F word he's really fond of in this movie that comes up a lot, that is just like, oh yeah, it was 1993. Like,
right.
Like bad guys in 1993. That's what they said.
But, yeah, and we're not talking about fuck either, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, but words like retarded and the other F word are really are just thrown around in this movie.
Willy and Nilly.
But it's really interesting to watch the dynamics of the two groups, because nobody has their shit together.
No.
And everybody, somebody in the group makes decisions that fuck over everyone. And it's really interesting to watch these dynamics. This is the thing about this movie, as trashy as it is, it's really kind of cleverly constructed in terms of its characters and what they do with them. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's very much about machismo and what it really takes to be a man. Because people who have the machismo, people who are like, I'm the fucking boss, they're the ones who end up pussing out. And it's the, you know, the guys who really stand up, the quiet guys, you know, the guy who's there for his family. You know, those are the guys. That's what a man is. And it's interesting that they, how hard they lean on that idea.
Yeah, and it's the perfect juxtaposition to the movie we talked about last week, Adventures in Babysitting, which is a movie in which every male character, almost down to a one, is completely useless. Funny thing about this movie, kind of the same situation. Like, nobody is particularly good. Even the professional criminals, ostensibly professional criminals, are not very good at killing four yuppies from the suburbs.
No, because it's that there's a certain realism to that, in that these are not movie villains. These are not guys who go and just kill wantonly.
Right.
You know, they kill when they have to, and it's a bloody, close, messy affair, and they just aren't ready for four other guys taking off.
Yeah. And my favorite thing about, and again, this is what another really great 90s thing, which we see again in Demolition Man, is even when you cast Dennis Leary as a character in a fictional film way outside of his persona as a stand-up comedian, there are still going to be moments where the movie grinds to a halt so that he can have his moment of stand-up, where he can deliver his little diatribe about, you know what I really don't like? You know what? Things that really bother me, just people that whine all the time. Just whine, 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 whine. And like basically doing Dennis Leary's stand-up as a mob boss.
Yeah, but that moment here is really fucking awesome.
Now, the third moment where he actually, where he says that, where he's talking about whining, I know what you, and that's a moment where he actually does something that's intimidating. There are at least two moments leading up to that where he's literally just like, you know what I hate? I hate liars. And I hate liars because blah, 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 blah. It's just like, okay, all right. He's going through his, like, basically I waited.
That's what you hired, hired him for in the 90s.
Right, but I was waiting for the other guy to show up with a guitar and then him just start singing asshole. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's, it was that much of a, of we're going to take a little detour from the very harrowing narrative that's going on so that Dennis Leary can rant a little bit. But yes, that third one, as he's drowning a guy in the sewer.
And he's so focused on him ranting and just talking and venting. Mm-hmm. He's not even paying attention to the fact that he's completely drowned this guy who he only meant to kind of slap around a bit.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just, and just that look on his face, as he realizes what he's done. It's kind of like, holy fuck, this guy's not right.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of fucking awesome.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that's one of the few moments in this film where I was like, okay, I totally buy Dennis Leary as, which it's a hard pill to swallow. I will say that honestly, it's a very hard pill to swallow. Dennis Leary as the sort of ruthless, although he played a not terribly dissimilar character in Suicide Kings,
yeah,
and did so very well.
Yeah, Suicide
it's really
Kings
strange.
A movie we should probably,
yeah, we'll definitely have to
up at some point.
Take your drink. Yeah, no, it's just that literally just dawned on me that I shouldn't have had a problem buying Dennis Leary as a ruthless criminal when he played that role so well in Suicide Kings, although Suicide Kings was not brought to us by the director of Nightmare on Elm Street 5 and Lost in Space. So I don't know, maybe that's a director performer thing. Although I will say this for Stephen Hopkins, who is apparently going to get kicked a little bit on this episode, I'm afraid. Just because his catalog, I will say, I will be completely honest, I liked Judgment Night. He also directed Predator 2, which I think is horribly underrated.
The film you refer to as the waiting room to the 90s?
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely the waiting room of the 90s, where all of these actors who were very big in the 80s are all thrown together in one place as if they are trying to decide whether their careers will survive the decade switch. But no, I really do like Predator 2. I'll give him that. And I, as a kid, saw Lost in Space in the theater. That's about as much good as I can say about that. And I do remember I enjoyed Blown Away. But I saw that, again, when I was very young, and I was in this kick of, like, I went through these spells watching movies as a kid where I wanted to watch, I would watch one movie I would like, and I wanted to watch every movie that was exactly like that movie. So, for example, when I first saw Die Hard, I spent months watching every terrorist take over a XYZ, you know, like we talked about with the Die Hardly episode, like Die Hard on a, Die Hard on a, Die Hard on a.
And so in other words, what you're saying is you watched Toy Soldiers like 80 times.
That's basically what I'm getting at. But I remember one of my favorite ones of the Die Hard ripoffs was Under Siege. And then, of course, I was like, Tommy Lee Jones is a bad guy. He's great. What other movies did Tommy Lee Jones play a bad guy in? Blown Away. Okay. And I liked it, I think, on that level, but I haven't revisited Blown Away in years. Does it hold up? Have you seen?
I have not revisited. I have that same trepidation about Blown Away, where it's kind of like, is that going to survive the 90s? I don't know.
Yeah. But I think where Stephen Hopkins benefits in Judgment Night is you have a group of people who, mishmashed as this cast may be, and very sort of randomly populated, the performers in this movie at this point in their careers were just so good that I think they elevate what is a really, you know, as we've said before, very trashy, brosploitation, very basic, very basic story.
Let me put you in the time machine and take you back 22 years for those of you who have no concept of what this cast really is. At the time, Emilio Estevez is the biggest star in the movie. Think about that.
Yeah,
Cuba Gooding Jr., Jeremy Piven, Stephen Dorff, Dennis Leary. The biggest star in the movie is Emilio Estevez, and his star is waning.
Like It is.
This is he's in the downward slide. He's not one of the cool kids anymore. You know, he's not making great movies. And this is that big budget Hollywood thriller with a young hip cast who all turns out to be fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is pre-Pulp Fiction and Usual Suspects. So nobody really knows about Green yet. You know, at this point, I think Cuba Gooding Jr. had done Gladiator.
And not, of course, the Russell Crowe Gladiator.
Not the
movie.
Russell Crowe Gladiator, the Gladiator where he boxes a guy who would go on to be a better director than an actor, Peter Berg. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, where
I've never seen Gladiator. So.
Oh, God. Oh. All right. That's a future episode.
Take a drink, everybody.
Because, you want to talk about really great, bro-y, awesome boxing films? Gladiator is actually really fucking satisfying. I'd be interested to rewatch that one. So it's really like that. Like, I recognize this guy. I'm like, oh, it's the guy from Gladiator. Gladiator was fucking awesome. Because I saw Gladiator in a theater at a test screening, and the audience was on its feet cheering in the final fight. Like, it was, everybody was fucking into this movie. I was surprised that it hadn't become a huge hit at the time. And then when Gladiator came out, the one everybody knows, I'm like, you can't just fucking take a movie's title like that. Gladiator fucking rocks. And then I went and saw Gladiator, and I'm like, okay, this owns the fucking title now. But
it's weird that Ridley Scott couldn't come down and take that title away. But what's interesting, you're absolutely right about his star waning, because Estevez was apparently, like, in the list of people that the studio wanted to play this lead role, Estevez was like 38th on that list. They really wanted Tom Cruise,
of course,
or Christian Slater,
of course.
All of them passed. In fact, like, the growing list of people that passed on this is kind of insane, and somehow everybody passes on this, and it ends up with Emilio Estevez. Which, I'm going to say this about Emilio Estevez: I know he's not necessarily the greatest actor in the world, but I've always really liked Emilio Estevez, and I don't know if that's because I grew up watching The Mighty Ducks, and so...
It's because you're a Mighty Ducks fan.
It might be, and then as I got a little bit older, and I discovered Breakfast Club, like, Breakfast Club is probably my favorite movie of the 80s, and, you know, obviously, like, that was... He was a big part of that, and then, of course...
And, of course, you're a huge Wisdom fan.
I don't know what Wisdom is.
The movie he directed.
Yeah, take a soundbite of that. Snip it out of the episode. Use that where you like. I don't know what Wisdom is, clearly, because I am talking about Judgment Night. But, again, that's kind of the brilliance of Judgment Night, is that you have a movie whose collected talent will not let it fail.
No.
When everything else about this movie should be either way too scant, way too contrived, just way too, I don't know, conventional to be anything of note. And to be fair, I'm sure a lot of people are still going, I'm sorry, Judgment Night? I don't know this one. And it was released in theaters. It was.
It with a big splash as well. Like, there were advertisements everywhere.
Yeah.
That's how I ended up seeing it, because they were really pushing it. And of course, you know, at the time, Dennis Leary was the new hotness, and Emilio Estevez could still put your ass in a seat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Estevez, he's channeling his dad here at times.
Yeah.
Like, there are some very Martin Sheen moments in his performance here where he just, you just look at him and you just see his dad.
Well, it's that more quiet type intensity that Martin Sheen had that he's actually kind of forced into, because all of the other characters around him, and this is what's really interesting, all of the other characters that they surround him with are loudmouths, are brash, cocky loudmouths, the exact type of character you would expect Estevez to be cast in, but he's actually the calm center of this group.
Yeah. And he's also, but he's up his own ass too, which is what's so cool about it. Like, there's this great line in there where, dude, your wife hates me. He's like, no, man, I've been married to her for 2 years. I can tell you, I know everything about her. And you just kind of sit there and snicker and go, 2 years. Get the fuck over yourself. Jesus.
I'm not sure you've learned everything in 2 years.
Yeah, you've got some time, my man. But they are all these brash loudmouths. You know, you really, there's moments in this movie you want to smack the shit out of Stephen Dorff.
Oh, you really do, because he is exactly, and I'm sorry, when Jeremy Piven in like full on Ari Gold to the max mode is telling you that this other character is a douchebag, that other character must be a real douchebag.
Oh, yeah.
And Stephen Dorff plays that up, and he absolutely lives up to that moniker that's assigned to him by, I'm just going to keep saying Ari Gold.
This is the proto-Ari Gold. The character he's playing here, he would then tap into for a number of other movies.
Yeah.
And when nobody remembers the movie, why bother abandoning that and going, no, I've already played that character. It's like, no, can you do that thing like you did in Judgment Night, except as an agent?
Watching Entourage right after Judgment Night is essentially alchemy, because, yeah, he's going to turn into gold. That's exactly what's going to happen.
He's great in this.
They're all great in this.
That's what holds
us together.
At their
bro-y best, they are still really good in this movie.
But there's a moment where he's negotiating with Dennis Leary,
mm-hmm.
and that back and forth between them and the way they both play it off is so fucking great.
Yeah.
Like, you're on pins and needles watching it. Like, is he actually going to, like, he's negotiating with the villain. Is he going to pull this off?
Yeah.
Is this going to fundamentally change the nature of the movie? What is going to happen here? It really is one of those where, and it keeps going back and forth, and it's a wonderfully paced and wonderfully acted scene. And it's the type of thing where the Warriors has this movie beat in terms of like action and sheer pageantry. This movie has the performances.
Yes.
Like, everyone is legitimately good.
And they all have moments where, even though these characters are really very broadly written, like, Cuba Gooding Jr. is the black athlete, and Stephen Dorff is the young hothead, and Jeremy Piven is the yuppie douchebag, and that's it. I mean, that's as much as they're really given as far as their character construction, but they all have these moments that they take full advantage of, and really, like, that scene. That scene where Jeremy Piven's negotiating happens because he's the one willing to hang back and do that. Like, they're not all standing there negotiating. The rest of them have run off and are on the other side of the building, like hiding and like hoping that he's able to. But it's like he's basically let them go on. Like, no, I'll take care of this. And that ends in such a heartbreaking way. And you realize, like, wait a minute, why are we feeling anything for the demise of this character who has been such an asshole? And it's because of Piven. It's because of that. And that's it across the board. What happens is these characters that on paper, man, I can't even imagine trying to read this screenplay. It would be so aggravating and so dull. And yet, when you cast the right people who are able to deliver those characters, but also deliver performances that are going to hold your attention and in some cases really make you empathize. I mean, that's creating magic. And I think that's exactly why we're talking about this movie today, is it's kind of lightning in a bottle.
Yeah. No, it's a really weird movie. And when you've busted Hopkins' balls a bit this episode.
Yeah.
And probably will continue to.
Yeah.
But he does a really great job here. Like the way he builds tension in scenes, there's some really great slow burn scenes in here. that sometimes it's very elegantly shot. You know, sometimes it's he's playing around with, you know, some of the early 90s stylish flourishes. But he really, like, during like some of the stalking scenes, like there's real genuine tension where you're just waiting for somebody to do something and you're on the edge of your seat. And it's really, really well put together. Some of the fight scenes are choreographed really well. The final fight scene between Emilio Estevez and
Dennis Leary.
Yeah, and Dennis Leary. Mm-hmm. Man, you would think if I said, oh, man, you need to check out this fight between Emilio Estevez and Dennis Leary, you'd be like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, seriously? And it's just a brutal, mean fight. Like, it's just mean.
Yeah.
And the only problem, there's one moment in the movie I don't like, and it's in that final scene.
Is it the beer boxes?
No, it's the,
that really
it's
bothered
the
me.
Bugs Bunny moment.
Oh, yeah.
Help me. I'll take you with me. I was like, yo, what? Why would you have him pull you up and then kick his ass again? Like,
you're doing this wrong. You're doing villaining wrong.
Yeah, this is...
Just so you know.
This is not how you villain.
That is not how you villain. I've been saying that since day one.
Yeah, no, that one moment, that's the one moment where I'm like, this movie's so good until right here, and I can forgive this, but God damn it, this was like almost like really, really, really well done.
Yeah.
But yeah, that Bugs Bunny moment is just like, oh, come the fuck on, and, guys.
Okay, so the thing about this movie that I think is really aggravating, and I'll be honest, as much as I like it, I have to point this out. There is, and we've talked about this before in other movies, and I don't know why filmmakers continue to do this. There are so many jokes that are clearly added ADR. There are so many, like, one-liners that no one is facing the camera when they say that are completely unnecessary. And it really does feel like they watched the first cut and they went, this is a little too dark. It's a little too dramatic. We need to lighten this up a little bit. Despite the fact that they are, like, filming it in what they are trying to sell is, like, hell's asshole. Like, the worst part of the world imaginable. Like, it makes Beirut look like a sunny vacation destination. And yet, they're like, oh, we need more jokes. And I feel like the movie would have been so much better served by just cutting that shit out.
I agree. Because there's the moments where the script is being clever,
mm-hmm.
and where it's clearly out of the script. The script is really clever.
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite exchanges is when Dennis Leary and his gang end up on someone else's turf.
Yes.
And they have kind of a standoff. And he pulls the other leader aside. And he's like, look, I understand. You know, you need to look strong. You can't let us roll over you. You know, what's this going to cost?
Yeah.
You know, how much is this going to cost? He's like, if I want your money, I take it. And then Dennis Leary's like, no, you would never take my money, but you could take my money. and you know, and just the way he delivers it, the way it you know, it jumps off the page. Really fantastic moment where, you know, he's really connecting with this other guy just so that he can run down these guys. And
you know what else? But speaking to what I was just saying and my point, like that scene, do you notice that there's the sound when they show the other gang, there's the sound of a lot of guns being cocked?
but you don't see any.
Not a single fucking gun on that anyone in that other gang. I'm like, whose weapons are being cocked exactly? Like, you see, like, it's clearly coming from their side of the screen, but then when they cut back, they're like, not a single one of them has a gun.
Yeah, that's
not one of them.
That sounds like something that happened in the editing room where they were like, why don't they have any guns? And it was like, it was a note from either producer or from the test audiences where they're like, why don't they have any guns?
We can't afford to go out and reshoot that.
Because they didn't have guns. And it's like, but they have guns. Why are they afraid? Because they're outnumbered.
You can't threaten people with no. You can't threaten people with guns with no guns. That just doesn't, like, that's movie rule number one. Everyone is doing villaining wrong. Everyone is doing heroing wrong. This is the exact counterpoint to Adventures in Babysitting, yes, where all male characters are fucking useless and have no idea what they're doing. And I'm not. You know, coming down on the movie for that. I actually think it's pretty fucking hilarious. But yeah, I really enjoy kind of, and I think you're right. I think there are moments of real tension, and I think there's a lot about this movie that works because just of the caliber of talent that they cast in these roles. Another thing that actually really works about the movie is the score. The soundtrack I've already talked about, and it's one song or whatever, it's that hip-hop song, but the score is done by Alan Silvestri.
Yeah,
and I had a really interesting moment where I had watched this right after I watched our movie next week, which is After Hours, and I believe it was, is it James Newton Howard that did the music for After Hours or somebody like that? And because I'd watched them back to back and I like looked away from the screen, for some reason, I got in my head that credit that I saw for After Hours was actually Judgment Night. So I'm sitting there watching Judgment, and I'm like, this is Howard? This sounds exactly like Alan Silvestri. That's so weird. Why is he doing an Alan Silvestri impression? And then sure enough, no, it is. It is Alan Silvestri. And it sounds a lot like, you know, the music that he does for Predator. But I think it works. I think it really works. I mean, he's got that ability to take just like the slightest, like, twitter of a xylophone and really build the tension of a scene. And what I think is interesting is he initially did a score for this movie that was rejected because it was entirely electronic. Like, Alan Silvestri went electronic for this movie initially, and they turned him down. And while I think the score that they actually used for the movie is very... is very effective, and there's a part of me that's frightened of the idea of an electronic Alan Silvestri score. There's another part of me that desperately wants to track down that electronic Alan Silvestri Judgment Night score.
Oh, I'd love to hear it. You know, that was a thing in 92, 93. There were a lot of cutting edge people trying to work with electronic music, and they were like, electronic music is where things are going. And there was so much pushback on it that people just rejected it whole hog.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, it became, you know, a major force in music. And now everything is done with computers, even when it's not electronic. But electronic music is so easy to make. It's so prevalent. But yeah, I would love to hear that score. Because this is actually the same era that Billy Idol did his famous electronic album, Cyberpunk. So I would love to hear what Alan Silvestri's 1993 electronic take was.
Yeah.
But the score here is great.
It is. But, you know, Silvestri is one of those guys that you can hear his scores a mile away.
Oh, yeah.
And as soon as you hear it, you know it's a Silvestri score. You just, it's so recognizable. So there's a part of me that wants to hear this electronic score just to be like, what does it sound like when Silvestri really steps outside of himself? Like, what does that sound like?
And what did that sound like 22 years
ago? What did it sound like 22 years ago? Another thing, you know, we were talking about this movie being sort of a 90s time capsule. And one of my favorite parts about that is that you mentioned Peter Green,
Yeah. Obviously
being one of the members of the gang following Dennis Leary around and trying to kill our heroes. However, did you know... that Eric Schrody plays one of the other henchmen. Eric Schrody, the former lead singer of House of Pain. Oh, yes.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, that is absolutely. In fact, there's a scene in the movie where they're looking at a ring that Jeremy Piven is trying to give them as like a, as a down payment on this money he's going to give them. And Shorty holds up his hand and he's got like a diamond shamrock.
Yeah, and it should have tipped me off because I remember that was big at the time.
Jump around.
He was in that and that, but then I could completely forgotten. So when I watched him, he looked familiar, but I couldn't quite place him.
Yeah.
That's Everlast, right?
That is, in fact, Everlast, yes. So, you know, if you thought Whitey Ford sang the blues before, just wait till he's in a cowboy shootout with Cuba Gooding Jr. It's such a weird, like, man, like, we talk about machismo in this movie.
Yeah.
That scene alone, where it's like both of them are shot and neither one of them want to die. They're just refusing to fucking die. And even when Schrody goes down, he's still shooting the gun at the floor in his last dying moments. Like, so impotent. Like, just this, like, flailing, like, I'm a tough guy, I'm dead.
Yeah, that I think is the magic of this film and what I really do dig about this film and why I think it's a worthy rewatch or seeking out.
Yeah.
Is it builds up the myth of the machismo, but these guys aren't movie heroes.
No.
Like the minute someone gets shot, just one shot, they are crawling across the floor, howling in pain, begging their friends not to leave them behind.
Yeah.
Like, this movie does not the, go on without me.
No.
Fuck that. Like, don't you fucking leave me, motherfucker. Oh, my God, it hurts so bad. Oh, my God. Like, literally.
This is really painful.
Half the group is shot to shit by the final sequence.
Yeah.
And they're literally, they put them in a closet and have them hiding in the closet so that they don't get fucked up any further. Like, this movie is very, like, realistic in its portrayal of just how readily you get fucked up.
Yeah.
And when the first villain eats it, holy shit, do the villains get pissed. Like,
yeah.
It's and like emotional, and it's not like other movie villains, like, oh, they got him, we'll get him now. It's just like Dennis Leary's like broken up, like,
yeah.
He's like, fuck.
Well, they were bros.
And so it's really interesting. Just so when the movie goes like full movie in the last 5 minutes and these guys are beating the shit out of each other, that's the only moment where it's kind of like, I think he probably would have been unconscious 3 hits ago. Like that punch he just swung would have knocked that guy the fuck out. Like,
yeah.
Let's be honest here. But you know, aside from that, yeah, the violence is all very like toned down and realistic, and these, you know, machismo dripping guys really are a bunch of fucking sissies, which is the fucking point. And that's what I find really interesting about this movie, is it's all about kind of unraveling the mystique of machismo and how it really just is posturing, and that real badasses don't need to fucking posture.
Yeah. And
do what they're supposed to do.
And I think that's exemplified in a scene where they're running for a bus, and the bus driver just decides, even though they're running toward the bus stop, she's like, no, these guys, no bros on the bus, and just keeps driving. And such a shitty thing to do, like, really.
And then Cuba Gooding Jr. pulls out a gun and starts shooting
at the bus. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? And Cuba Gooding goes into this rant where he's basically accusing Emilio Estevez of being a pussy. Like, ever since you had a kid, you've become a total pussy. And Emilio Estevez is like, I'm sorry, are you not a pussy because you have a gun? I don't understand.
Shot at a bus?
Because you shot at a bus? Are you kidding me? So, yeah, I think this movie, either consciously or just from how inept these characters are in their quest to either kill or not be killed, is kind of deconstructing that myth of machismo, and it works on that level as something that's, you know, between that and just being a total 90s time capsule, really is, and on top of all of that, it's just fun to watch. Like, these guys in their element, either right at the start of their careers or at the peak of it, whatever the case may be, like, really just owning it and really elevating the material, and just makes it really fun to watch. And it's just an out and out entertaining movie. You know, even that scene, that weird scene where they're like packed into these boxcars with all these like really like creepy armies of homeless guys. Like, what are they doing? Just like standing, they're all standing in there. Like these homeless guys are just standing like cattle in this boxcar. Like the trains aren't moving. They're not going anywhere. It's just, it's very bizarre. But like, you know, like we've talked about before with other movies that are taking place over the course of one night, they try to create as broad a landscape as possible of really bizarre characters. And in this movie, almost to a one, it is like economically downtrodden people. Like there's like different degrees of crazy homeless people. And then there's like the people who are living in those projects. There's the other gang. And then, of course, the other douchey bros that they meet on the highway, which is almost too, you know, we talk about, you know, trying to draw these characters so they're a little bit more over the top and fantastical. Those guys are a little too on the nose. Like the guys that they get in the fight with on the freeway. Oh, yeah. I'm like, yeah, I don't think those guys are drawn absurdly enough. That makes total sense to me. But yeah, no, it's just, it's a really entertaining movie. You do actually feel for these characters despite their broiness, on both sides even. And I do think it's funny that what finally does Dennis Leary in, what finally helps Emilio Estevez get the upper hand and deliver the killing blow, if you pay attention, is that he kicks Dennis Leary in the balls. And earlier in the movie, Dennis Leary says to Jeremy Piven, like, you and your friends are the kind of like fruit fed bait that I hate because you always got to look down to make sure you have a dick. I have one. And sure enough, what ends up doing him in is Emilio Estevez kicking him in the dick.
Yeah. Well, and also what ends up doing him in is he thinks he's being a tough guy. And he's like, I think I'm going to pay a visit to your pretty little wife.
Yeah.
I think you're going to, how old is your daughter again? Oh, you're never going to see her again. And then, you know, Emilio Estevez just loses his shit. He's like, goes, what are you going to fucking do to my daughter? And starts pummeling the shit out of him. And it's like, why'd you have to go and piss him off?
It's a very, and where they're fighting is a really weird set piece because it looks like a fish market or like some kind of like open air grocery store. And then there's like housewares and all of this random shit just stacked everywhere that, you know, was just stacked there so they could knock it over. Like, it doesn't really function as any, because it's in a warehouse, but it looks like a, like they're selling shit that you would buy at Target. Like, it's just, it is bizarre. Like, it only, the only actual logistical function that it serves is a fight scene. This is the location for a fight scene. There's no way that practically would be a place. And
I don't know. I mean, it could have been at the time. It could have been one of those, you know, just bazaars, you know.
That's a good word for it on a lot of levels.
Yeah, that some place in Chicago where they had that sort of thing. And
it also has an elaborate system of ribbon banners because they have circus performers in there as well.
What's interesting is this is one of those movies that just could not exist today.
No.
Like, the plot of this movie would never happen because they would be on the freeway and they would be, oh, hey, I found a route to get around all this traffic. Yeah. And they would be at the boxing match and that was it. And even if they took a wrong turn somewhere, you know, your phone would readjust and get you back on track. And then even if you hit somebody, you could actually reach the cops.
Yeah.
You know, every bit of this movie is stopped by the fact that, oh, hey, by the way, technology allows us to get around problems like this.
And I agree, but I don't know that technology would have even saved them because the minute they get off the highway, they're apparently in Hobbs End. Like, there's no getting out of this place, and it doesn't seem connected to the real world.
You gotta make me like Captain America there. I understood that reference.
I understood that reference. They literally, like, they just, it's a major city. It's fucking Chicago. They take one wrong exit, and there is no getting back to the highway or anything resembling a highway. This is some kind of nightmare town that exists in a parallel dimension where once you enter it, you cannot leave.
Well, yeah, once you get off the highway, you enter Night City. and you know, there is no sun. It's always nighttime.
Yep.
All the barrels are burning.
Do you read Sutter Kane?
Yeah. But, you know, as far as, you know, the thing that worked about it, especially at the time, is that's everybody's fear, is that you're going to get off the highway and end up in this terrible place, whether it be, you know, backwood rednecks, or whether it be, you know,
Dennis Leary,
urban blight with crazy Dennis Leary, you know,
something I fear every day of my life. I take a wrong turn, end up in Dennis Leary's territory.
Oh yeah, and the worst part is where
he makes me watch every episode of Rescue Me.
He starts ripping off Bill Hicks left and right.
Oh,
like he's chasing you down, and you're just like, "That's a Bill Hicks joke."
Wow.
Pay rare respects.
Wow. Oh boy. Oh boy. He's gonna come after you in your dreams. Dennis Leary / Freddy Krueger is going to one of my favorite random Dennis Leary moments in this movie, by the way. Just so unnecessary. Like, kind of understand it considering where the movie's set, but feels like a Dennis Leary ad lib more than anything else. Is Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character has a Letterman's jacket from Purdue.
Oh yeah.
And he ends up shooting a homeless Dennis Leary shoots a homeless guy that he thinks is Cuba Gooding Jr. because he's wearing the jacket, and he says, "Shit, hobo from Purdue. I hate Purdue. When's the last time they ever won anything anyway?" And I'm like, is that really pertinent right now, Dennis Leary? Or are you just going to shit on Purdue for no reason? Sure. Why not? Dennis Leary, folks. Master criminal and super bro himself, Dennis Leary.
Don't move. Don't whisper. Don't even breathe.
Well, that, of course, brings us to the junk food pairing. And I feel like this is the kind of movie, would you agree that this is the kind of movie that you really need to sit down and enjoy a few brews while you watch?
A few bros?
A few brews with your bros.
Brews and bros. So yeah.
A few
brews and bros movie.
A few bro brews, if you will. Perhaps an entire 12er of Natty Ice. Because this is, again, one of the most bro-ish movies I think I have ever
seen. I'm worried about bro rape at this point if you're pulling out the Natty Ice.
Yeah, and you might want to be concerned about that. So drink responsibly with your bros, your case of Natty Ice. The broiest of the brews on the market. Enjoy that, but don't really enjoy that because, good God, Natty Ice. How is that beer? How is that fit for human consumption? How is the FDA not swooped in and said, oh, for the love of God, just drink varnish instead? It's better for you. Damn it, Natty Ice. But this movie's good.
You do realize this is going to be our first lawsuit letter.
Bring it on. Your fucking beer tastes like sewer swill. Like, I would rather have Jason Voorhees dunk me headfirst into that barrel of slime and rat turds that he dunked that drug dealer in Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan into, then drink a single drop of Natty Ice. Oh, you bring it on, powerful Natty Ice lobby. I am sitting here waiting for you.
Can I just say I'm a bit disappointed in all the Jason Takes Manhattan references and no fucking Dream Child references, like, at all.
Dream Child is so bad. I don't even want, even though we're talking about the director, I fucking hate that movie so much.
Do you think that's the worst of the nightmares?
It's real close with Freddy's Dead. Like, it's super close, because Freddy's Dead has that awful power glove joke in it.
And it has Roseanne and Tom Arnold.
Yeah, it is neck and neck between those two. I mean, if either one of them has the edge, it's probably Freddy's Dead because of that stupid-ass 3D gimmick they tried to pull at the end.
Oh, God, yeah. Do you have any of those 3D glasses by any chance?
I think I might.
Those 3D glasses are fucking amazing. I had my set for years from when I went. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally glasses on one side, it says, you know, Friday or Nightmare on Elm Street Part 6, Freddy's Dead. And on the other side, it's advertising a new movie coming out soon, Suburban Commando.
Holy shit, Suburban Commando.
So quite literally, there are these 3D glasses with fucking Suburban Commando advertisements on it for Freddy's Dead.
Raise your hand if you went out once just running some errands and came home with a DVD copy of Suburban Commando. I'm raising my hand right now. I did that. I'm sort of ashamed of it.
You should be.
I should be.
But so
anyway,
so Natty Ice. that's the junk food recommendation for the week that we apparently also don't recommend. So
the only thing better to spend your $8 on than a 24 pack of Natty Ice would be a DVD copy of Suburban Commando, and I fucking mean that. I'll say it again. Anyway, that's our show for this week. We are definitely going to be closing out this particular theme next week with After Hours, the forgotten Martin Scorsese film that I'm excited to talk about. But in the meantime, you can find us on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm. That's MassaWyrm. And at facebook.com/Massaworm.
You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury, as well as on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. You can also find me at oneofus.net, my home away from home. Lots of great geek podcasts and blogs over there for every taste. And definitely keep, you know, come back here next week, because we are going to be talking once again about After Hours, and I'm super excited to do that. But in the meantime, remember this as you make your way through life and through all of the trials and tribulations, all of the long nights as our characters in this movie have to endure. Just remember, don't move, don't whisper, don't even breathe.